everybody. My name is Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer, and welcome to the Tactical Tennis Podcast. Today, we're talking about your opponent and how to make them uncomfortable.
And by that, we don't mean staring at them awkwardly on changeovers.
Yes. Please don't do that. Although, I mean, if that's going to win the match, then no, just kidding. But in all seriousness, one of the fundamental things that I coach, and tell me if you're doing this explicitly as much as I am, I tell people, look, figure out what your opponent really likes to do and don't ever let them do it.
Yeah, I use slightly different phrasing when I talk about that, but it's the same kind of idea. I typically talk about this battle in a match where you have the thing that you like to do, they have the thing that they like to do, and the person who gets to do the thing that they like the most often is going to win.
That's pretty good, yeah.
So basically it's the same idea, and I think this is something that is often underrated, because a lot of times people play to their own strengths exclusively when they play matches, but they don't spend a lot of time actually, when I say play to their opponent's weaknesses, really what we're talking about is actually making their opponent do things that they're not comfortable doing.
Right. And I think that's the key. The example that I use is, I think that we get distracted when we say play to their weaknesses, especially when you're talking about high-level players. The higher you get, the less it's about playing at someone's weakness, because the quote-unquote weakness can still be good enough to hurt you. So the example that I use is Rafa Nadal. If you're playing Rafa and he's hitting forehands from the backhand side of the court, where he's hitting basically inside-out forehands, or what Craig O'Shaughnessy calls, I think, from the C or C-plus or area of the court, if he's standing over there on the ad side, or sorry, on the deuce side, since he's a lefty, and hitting forehands, or for a right-handed player, if they're over there on, obviously, the ad side, then you're just going to have a really tough day, because basically the guy's got so much confidence, he's going to move you around, and even if you're playing really great, he feels really great. So he's going to have the wherewithal to stand up to whatever you're throwing at him.
Absolutely, because you're playing on his terms.
Right, and that's the way to think about it. You're playing on his terms. So if you play Rafa, what's his best shot? Well, his forehand's his best shot, but ironically, you can't let him hit inside-out forehands, which leads you pretty much to having to play him in the forehand corner, because Lord knows the whole world's tried to play him into the backhand corner. That's why he's so good at hitting inside-out forehands. Right? So it's not that you're playing to a weakness, but it's that you have to play him in a pattern that he doesn't like as much, that he's less comfortable winning points from there.
Absolutely. And I mean, the analogy, this example would be Federer. People have had good success attacking Federer's forehand, even though his forehand is obviously a phenomenally great shot, because he also likes to run around and hit the inside out. A lot of times these players, even their best shot is only their best shot under certain circumstances.
Right.
So the idea is, let's take people out of their comfort zone. And this can, well, I guess the first question we have here is, obviously most of you aren't going to go out and play against Rafael Nadal or Roger Federer or really anybody that you've got to watch or had the opportunity to watch play a lot of matches previously.
Well, there are the times when we have those league matches, and you and I have been in this situation where we've got the league and you've seen guys around season after season, and so you have a pretty good idea of what to expect. But outside of that, there's also the times where, you know, we're playing guys for the first time.
Right, yeah. If you play a tournament, or, yeah, like even in your league, you might have a new guy come into town. And so, look, when you're playing somebody that you have seen play a lot before, or you know their game well, then it's a lot easier to identify those things that they do well and don't do well, and at least have an idea of a strategy to make them uncomfortable. But when you're playing somebody who you haven't played before, that gets a little bit trickier, because you don't want to wait until you're a set and a breakdown to figure out the thing that makes them uncomfortable, because things are probably a little bit late at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what we really want to do is either figure that out very early on in the match, or if possible, even during the warm-up. And this gets us into some sticky territory, because it's very easy, I think, for people to misjudge their opponents based on warm-ups. And a funny story. So I played some ITF tournaments in Malaysia I think I referenced it in the episode we talked about Miami. So one of the tournaments we got to play at the base of a mountain, which was a lot of fun. But there was also another tournament that we played that wasn't at the base of a mountain and wasn't so much fun for me because I lost my first round match. I played this guy who had a really funky grip, and actually he was hitting basically a continental. And everything I knew about tennis said, well, he can't take a high forehand down the line very well. And so I spent a set and a half coming in to his forehand off the high ball, expecting him to basically have to hook across court. And he adapted really, really well and actually owned that shot. And he kept passing me down the line, passing me down the line. And, you know, I was 15 at the time. And, you know, I'm in a foreign country playing tennis and not thinking on my best terms. And a set and a half down, I finally, you know, was so frustrated that this guy was doing the thing that he wasn't supposed to be able to do. So it's very easy to misread somebody in a warm-up sometimes and then form a strategy that's actually not a good strategy as a result of that. But that doesn't mean we can't get useful information.
Right.
The trick is what information we do get from what we have to be willing to adapt to actual match play relatively quickly. So as an example of things that we might want to look for in a warm-up, if you see somebody who does have an extreme grip on either side, their forehand or their backhand, if somebody's hitting a full Western, then the odds of them being able to handle the low ball well are not super great. I'm not saying they definitely won't be able to do it, but the odds of them being able to do that are lower.
Well, there's better odds that they're not going to be able to do it. This is one of the things that you see, say, in college level and up. Sometimes guys will have an extreme grip, but then it's been attacked so much, whether that's on a low ball or a high ball, that they've adapted really well, and they can actually – sometimes they actually like the ball there because it seems that's what everyone does.
Sure.
Generally speaking, that would be, say, a high ball. Like, you don't see a lot of guys that are consistently getting attacked with slice these days.
No, these days it's not that common.
It's pretty much like high ball. So you do have guys who have grip weaknesses – for the high stuff, but they've compensated really well. So you have to figure that out. If they have, you know, figured out how to really play those high balls well, even though their grip says they shouldn't handle it, like the guy that you played, not at a base of a mountain. I'm glad we were specific about the location there.
Have to be. You know, I don't want people to be confused by my junior ITF career.
Yeah. I mean, if we didn't lose matches, we never would have learned anything, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, if you see someone that adapts to that, then you have to figure out, okay, well, you know, this guy's probably practiced this shot a lot, you know. And we see this all over the case on the Pro Tour where you see a stroke and you look at it and you think, well, it shouldn't be that good over there. But they have some way to manage that.
Absolutely. And, of course, at the pro level, a lot of these guys are fundamentally just very athletic, which allows them to compensate in ways that your average recreational player won't be able to. But the point still stands. There are some very, very athletic recreational players out there. So what you don't want to do is take what you think might be a weakness and just assume that it is one and base your entire game plan around it. You do want to probe it, especially in the warm-up if you can, and try and expose and see. Like, look, if you think a guy's carrying a full Western grip and is going to struggle with the low ball, then hit him a couple low balls. And if he sits there and just very calmly handles them beautifully, then that's probably not going to be your go-to play in the match. But the point
right.
is you do want to just have an eye out for these kinds of things in the warm-up and look for those possibilities. The way a guy hits a backhand, he may struggle with the high ball. You just got to look for those things that maybe are a little bit funky. But understand the moment the match play starts, you have to adapt to what's in front of you.
You've got to. And I think the idea is to always have a constant eye out for what does this guy want to do? And in a sense, part of your job is to frustrate him. Don't let him do what he wants to do. And that can change a little bit. You know, I mean, it doesn't, not everyone has only one go-to play. Some guys have more varieties than others. And, you know, how you use limitations, so you think of, you know, a grip or someone who struggles with a high backhand. Like, you mentioned the ITF tournaments, and so I have an ITF, one of the top 10 ITF guys in mind right now, who is known for having a really, really good backhand. Ironically, he's pretty lousy at hitting a high backhand. But what he does instead is he's compensated and he basically slaps that ball down the line really low. So it's a really effective shot and he can always make it down the line, but he can't hit a high backhand cross court. So you know, if you actually watch him, then you can't just assume he's going to miss all the shots every time you hit a high to his backhand. But you have to understand that you probably only need to cover half the court, because that's where he's going to want to hit it, and that's where he's going to go all the time. So even those kinds of things where you just – if you can just figure out, I know where this guy's going to hit to this half of the court, I mean, that can be a game changer in a match.
Oh, absolutely. So coming back to this whole idea of the warm-up, the other thing that we do want to look at for a little bit is what people have a habit of doing. So if you, one thing that I like to do in warm-ups is hit a ball – not just one, but multiple balls – straight at a person, not in the trying to hit them kind of way, but in the baseline rally, and see which way they move. Because if I hit the ball at them and they go to the left, let's say they're right-handed, they go to the left and make a forehand out of it every single time, and that movement looks very easy and natural, then I'm going to assume they spend a lot of time practicing hitting the inside out and inside in forehands and running around that backhand. So that could be another indicator.
Yeah.
But if they go to the backhand every single time and hit it well, then that probably also tells me the backhand's better than their forehand, because who the heck runs around their forehand, you know,
yeah.
besides Gasquet, and even he doesn't do it, though he probably should.
I mean, and like you said before, I mean, what you don't want to do is take something from the warm-up and then commit to that for the whole day. You have to constantly test, because I can tell you for me, I mean, you know that I'm a weird science geek, but like I used to run around forehands and hit my backhand because it was the worst shot, because I was trying to get more repetitions in.
Sure.
I was trying to figure it out, you know.
Yeah, but and you're I think a little unusual in that regard.
I'm totally unusual in that regard. The point is that you made a good point earlier on that you can't just take, you know, some simple pattern for the warm-up and then say, oh, you know, that's going to be the gold standard and I have to stay with it no matter what. You have to try it out and see what works, and you have to use the stuff that's working.
Absolutely. So once we get into actual match play, again, one of the things that I said at the very beginning was this idea of any match is a battle between the thing that you want to do and the thing that they want to do. And what you want to do is be keeping an eye out from the very beginning of actual point play and look for the things that they're trying to implement, even if they don't necessarily implement them well right at the beginning. Sometimes this might be because you miss a ball, and you can still get a lot of information out of your misses, because let's say, for example, that you hit a backhand that's going straight up the middle of the court, or a little bit to the right of center towards their backhand, and it ends up going slightly long, but they've run around it, they're posting up ready to hit an inside out forehand, right? Mm-hmm. Even though you've missed the shot, you can still learn that, look, they were looking to create a pattern there. They were looking to create a certain specific shot for themselves, and that's information that you can use.
Now, tell me what you think of this. Oh, man. I just dropped my mic. That was fun. Tell me what you think of this.
Are you lying on the floor now?
No, I caught it, but I knocked over a picture successfully.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks, housing family.
oh, snap.
It's fine. It's not damaged or anything. I'm not that kind of guy. We get along really well. Anyway, so a lot of the times over the first, I'll take the first two service games of my opponent throughout a match, right? Because on my serve, I want to focus on the patterns I think that you've practiced. Like, you have to try to do the things that win for your service game. Mm-hmm. But on my opponent's serve, I'll take those first two games and really just play up the middle, right? Mm-hmm. Because that sort of hands control over to my opponent, and I'll look for it. Okay, well, how are they trying to win points against me in those first two games? Which is a little bit different than the warm-up, because they're probably going to immediately go into establishing the patterns that they like. I mean,
oh,
that's
absolutely.
My thinking.
Yeah, nobody's going to go out there and intentionally hit their weak shot early in a match just so they can get extra repetitions. Not even you would do that,
no,
Jacob.
Not even I would. I never did that.
Right.
Like, it's once the match starts, it's game on, and you're bringing the best stuff that you have.
Yes, and I think that that's actually a brilliant play for people for the first one to two service games in their opponent for a couple reasons. One is that it does expose, in a sense, their motivation, what it is that their intent. What are they trying to do? If you give them a ball in the middle, what is it they're going to do with that shot? Which side are they trying to hit? What pattern are they trying to create? That's incredibly useful. The second part of it is, in a lot of ways, I mean, you've eliminated angles. You're playing up the middle, which is a fairly safe play. And
yep.
If they do come out and they're the kind of player who has a jittery start, and you just make them hit a bunch of balls where they have to create, Well, you can sometimes get a lot of errors out of them before they actually get into a rhythm, which, it doesn't really fit our category of necessarily making people uncomfortable in terms of the tennis side of things, but I think it's just worth mentioning. But absolutely hitting up the middle can expose the things that they want to do, which we can then use to create a game plan. I think now it's important to change gears a little bit and let's talk about how to respond to some very specific scenarios. So if we take like the classic American player, which is the big serve, big forehand, right? They
Yes.
spend a lot of time posting up in the ad court, hitting the inside out forehand. And it's not just limited to Americans. I don't want to, Carlos Moyer was known to do that once or twice in his career. Rafa does it a lot. Fed does it a lot. I mean, look, a lot of players these days use the forehand as a weapon. They set up and hit inside out forehands. What I'm getting at here is this is something that we see a lot of, and it's good to know how to handle that.
So how do you coach players, let's say, of, below a college level, how to handle that?
Right. So there's a couple things that are important thoughts. One is, what am I actually trying to do here? Is my goal to get an error out of the forehand, or is my goal to open up the backhand? Because my play is going to vary a little bit depending on my answer to that question, first of all. But generally speaking, the idea here is we want to go into the forehand corner and pull them away from the inside out, because that does a couple things for us. One, that creates a situation where they're having to hit their forehand on the run. And most people, this isn't true of everybody, but most people tend to play at a lower level when you make them run while playing tennis. There are some people who actually do it better, but most people tend to do a little
It's pretty rare. I mean, it's universally harder to do stuff on the run. That's like saying some people play better at a faster speed, which is true, but if you can run someone enough.
Right, everybody breaks down eventually. If you make them run enough, everybody breaks down eventually. Some people are actually better hitting on the run for a couple shots, but point being, they're rare. The vast majority of people, when you make them run, are going to have a tougher time of things. So you've just created a running forehand for your opponent instead of one where they're basically in position and controlling the point. The second thing is you've created a level of predictability. Because if I make somebody run into their forehand corner and hit a forehand on the run, they're unlikely to take that ball down the line. Why? Because they're hitting over the high part of the net into the shortest part of the court, and their margin for error is much lower. So if they do take that ball down the line, generally speaking, they're going to make more mistakes, which means the play is to take it cross court. What I've done now has also given myself a level of control, because by taking the ball into the forehand corner, they now go cross court. Assuming I'm right-handed, they're heading into my forehand, and I've also been able to predict somewhat where that ball's going to go. So that's a great start, right? Now I've got my opponent standing in their deuce court. And again, I'm talking mostly about right-handers here. You obviously reverse all this for the lefty. But so I've got my opponent standing in the deuce court corner, and now the ad court is wide open. And ideally, I'm actually either going to hit a forehand, which I can take down the line, or I'm going to hit a backhand cross court. And either way, I'm in a great situation now.
Now, it's funny to me that you said that most people aren't going to hit a forehand down the line when they're on the run, because I find that most people actually do. It's just that most people should not do that, right?
Right.
So they either hit it down the line and often miss, or they try and hit it cross court, but they haven't actually practiced that and they're not good enough to do that, so they really hit it middle.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Either way, what we have done is open up the ad court.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
That's what.
that's obviously a very positive thing to have happen. So that's one scenario where we're basically taking somebody who's doing what they like to do and they're very comfortable with it. And we're changing that dynamic and forcing them to do something maybe that they're not as comfortable with. Let's take another example, and we can snatch this one straight from the Pro Tour, which would be former world number one, Novak Djokovic. And if we look at the things
Yes.
that he really likes to do, that generally does involve running laterally side to side on the baseline. This
Love
is
it.
something that he does better than anybody has ever done in the history of the sport.
Fair.
As far as just straight lateral movement, the
Yeah.
guy is, I can't even call him a machine, right? Because machines actually break down sometimes. And Novak Djokovic seems to just do this indefinitely forever. And one of the things that if you want to beat Novak Djokovic is you can't let him do that. And so if we take Stanislaw Wawrinka, who's had some success against Djokovic, when Djokovic has been playing well on the big stage, One of the things that Wawrinka has done a great job of when he's played Djokovic is take the match from being a lateral match, where we talk about running side to side, and turned it into a vertical match where he's hitting through the court, right, with power and depth, and forcing Djokovic back and changing that dynamic. So Djokovic doesn't get to run side to side as much anymore. When he runs, it's because he's running after a Wawrinka backhand winner.
Right.
And that's a very different thing. Or the flip side of that is you could take what Federer has done against Djokovic with success in the past, and especially if you go back about 10 years, he used to do this more, which was use the slice backhand and draw Djokovic forward into playing short balls low in the court, and oftentimes kind of forcing him to come into the net behind those shots, where Djokovic is at his least best. The two shots that Djokovic hits worst in tennis are volleys and overheads.
Yeah, ironic. And I want to point out that, you know, it may not be clear to everyone, we've coached a lot of players that are at actually a pretty low level, both of us. I know that you have, and I know that I have as well. So clearly we can say, you know, for Novak, this is how you can change the game against him. And I think it's easy for us to look at that and say, okay, well, like, I'm not playing Novak Djokovic. The point that I take away from that is you've got multiple ways that you can break Novak Djokovic out of his favorite patterns. And his pattern is, hey, I can run down anything and I can make every shot and I can hit winners on you from the forehand or the backhand side. So if you can get to him, then you can get to anybody.
Absolutely. And this stuff tends to scale. And this is important because when we talk about players, they tend to fall into categories. Like, we have different types of players. So you have your kind of counterpuncher who likes to run side to side. You have your kind of Fabrice Santoro character who's largely self-taught and hits funky spins and hits the ball short and then deep and then off to the side. You know, you have your kind of archetypical power player who hits the big serve and tries to crack a big forehand. They just don't do it as well as the guys in the Pro Tour do, but the style is there. Just like you will have your own style, not you, Jacob, but you people listening. Well, you'll all have your own style. You'll all be your own type of player that'll also fit some kind of a mold. And it's not that you have to train.
Nobody has my style.
Yeah. Are we calling it a style now? I'm just kidding. It's not that you have to go out and train to beat Novak Djokovic specifically. It's understanding when I play this type of player who likes to run side to side and just get everything back, right, then these are some of the options that I might have to make them uncomfortable.
So I have a guy in mind who I worked with for a little while who used to love to hit from the baseline and just had like the world's worst volleys. And I watched him go play new people that hadn't played him before. And I mean, they just tried to beat him from the ground and nothing really worked because he was basically better than everyone else in that league. But then if he played the right kind of guy who was smart enough, he would literally just bring him into the net all the time, completely rattled the guy, took him out of his game, so to say. And I mean, the guy was hopeless at winning matches if he had to come to the net 20 times.
It's amazing what can happen if you make somebody do things they're not so good at. You know, I know it sounds like such an obvious statement, but really this is in large part what successful winning tennis is about. It's not just about you doing the things that you do well. It's about making them also do the things that they don't do very well. And if we can do that, then we're generally going to have a lot of success.
You have to integrate those things. And I mean, before we wrap up, this is the idea that we want to get across today, right? Is a big part of being able to come out ahead of your opponent and win a match is going to be to influence them in a way so that they're not in their best state. Because if they're playing perfect, flawless tennis, then at best it's going to be a coin flip that you're going to come out ahead, right?
Yeah, it's probably not going to be a great day for you.
You're probably not going to win when they're playing perfect, flawless tennis. Like, we can count how many matches on the tour we've seen where both guys are playing absolutely phenomenal A-plus tennis. And those go down as the greatest matches of all time. And we absolutely love them. But that's not what we see on a day-in and day-out basis, right?
No, that's not how careers are made.
No, and I mean, I've seen you build college teams off of just identifying very quickly specific tactics to break down an opponent and to say, okay, like, you've got your player, you know what your basic patterns are. Hopefully you've done at least that much work on your game so you know how you like to win points. And then just, as you know, simple adjustments of, okay, try and get your opponent over here to do something that they don't like 20, 25 times, and consistently your players come out on top.
Oh, it's, you know, thankfully I've gotten a little better at identifying the weaknesses than I was when I was 15. And that certainly helps. I mean, I certainly, one match that leaps to mind was when I was working with the Emory women's team in the middle of their national championship run. And we went up to Virginia to play a match. And I was working with one of the players who had a very complete game. And her opponent was playing lights out. So we're down a break in the first set. And I went over and I watched for 5 minutes and just noticed that only on the backhand, if you gave her a low ball, that she really struggled with that shot. I just noticed something in the technique of the way she hit that ball, and gave that little bit tidbit to our player, and she ended up rolling through that match in straight sets. I think she lost two more games the rest of the match. Just from and look, this girl was good. Like, the girl we're playing against was good. I mean, this was a nationally ranked team. This is a high line. It was, I think, line two or line three in singles. This was no pushover. This wasn't a girl who was out there and didn't have any idea how to play tennis or had like this glaring, obvious weakness. It was just that identifying that one weakness gave us the ability to get control of points and impose our patterns of play. So if you can identify that one shot, we just knew that if we gave her the right type of low short ball, we were going to get control of the point. And now we're playing our patterns, and being able to consistently switch from her patterns to our patterns was the difference between losing a match in straight sets and winning a match in straight sets. And we got that just from a single shot. So, I mean, it's massively impactful. And I hope that this has helped all of you listeners out there. But if there's any part that you want clarification on, by all means, please do shoot us an email. We'd love to hear your questions and kind of learn more about the things that you're struggling with. You can reach me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
And I'm jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
And we'd love to hear from you folks. So on that note, we'll sign off, bid you adieu, and have a great day.
See you guys.